Thursday, February 22nd, 1906. Susie's remarks about her grandfather Langdon, Mr. Clemens tells about Mr. Atwater, Mr. David Gray, and about meeting David Gray Jr. at a dinner recently. I have wandered far from Susie's chat about her grandfather, but that is no matter. In this autobiography, it is my purpose to wander whenever I please and come back when I get ready. I have now come back, and we will set down what Susie has to say about her grandfather. From Susie's biography, I mentioned that Mama and Papa couldn't stay in their house in Buffalo because it reminded so much of Grandpapa. Mama received a letter from Aunt Susie in which Aunt Susie says a good deal about Grandpapa, and the letter showed so clearly how much everyone that knew Grandpapa loved and respected him that Mama let me take it to copy what is in it about Grandpapa, and Mama thought it would fit in nicely here. Quarry Farm, April 16th, 85. Livy, dear, are you not reminded by today's report of General Grant, of Father? You remember how, as Judge Smith and others whom Father had chosen as executors were going out of the room, he said, "Gentlemen, I shall live to bury you all," smiled, and was cheerful. At that time he had far less strength than General Grant seems to have, but that same wonderful courage to battle with the foe. All along there has been much to remind me of Father, of his quiet patience, in General Grant. There certainly is a marked likeness in the souls of the two men. Watching day by day the reports from the nation's sick room brings to mind so vividly the days of that summer of 1870. And yet they seem so far away. I seemed as a child compared with now, both in years and experience. The best and the hardest of life have been since then to me, and I know this is so in your life. All before seems dreamy. I suppose this was because our lives had to be all readjusted to go on without that great power in them. Father was quietly such a power in so many lives beside ours, Livy dear, not in kind or degree the same to anyone, but, oh, a power. The evening of the last company, I was so struck with the fact that Mr. Atwater stood quietly before Father's portrait a long time, and turning to me said, "We shall never see his like again," with a tremble and a choking in his voice. This after 15 years, and from a business friend. And some stranger a week ago spoke of his habit of giving as so remarkable, he having heard of Father's generosity. I remember Mr. Atwater very well. There was nothing stiffified about him or his ways. He was in middle age, and had lived in the country all his life. He had the farmer look, the farmer gait. He wore the farmer clothes, and also the farmer goatee, a decoration which had been universal when I was a boy, but was now become extinct in some of the western towns and in all of the eastern towns and cities. He was transparently a good and sincere and honest man. He was a humble helper of Mr. Langdon, and had been in his employ many years. His role was general utility. If Mr. Langdon's sawmills needed unscientific but plain common-sense inspection, Atwater was sent on that service. If Mr. Langdon's timber rafts got into trouble on account of a falling river or a rising one, Atwater was sent to look after the matter. Atwater went on modest errands to Mr. Langdon's coal mines, also to examine and report upon Mr. Langdon's interests in the budding coal oil fields of Pennsylvania. Mr. Atwater was always busy, always moving, always useful in humble ways, always religious and always ungrammatical, except when he had just finished talking and had used up what he had in stock of that kind of grammar. He was effective, that is, he was effective if there was plenty of time, but he was constitutionally slow, and as he had to discuss all his matters with whomsoever came along, it sometimes happened that the occasion for his services had gone by before he got them in. Mr. Langdon never would discharge Atwater, though young Charlie Langdon suggested that course now and then. Young Charlie could not abide Atwater, because of his provoking dilatoriness and of his comfortable contentment in it. But I loved Atwater. Atwater was a treasure to me. When he would arrive from one of his inspection journeys and sit at the table at noon and tell the family all about the campaign in delicious detail, leaving out not a single inane, inconsequential, and colorless incident of it, I heard it gratefully. I enjoyed Mr. Langdon's placid patience with it, the family's despondency and despair, and more than all these pleasures together, the the vindictiveness in young Charlie's eyes and the volcanic disturbances going on inside of him which I could not see, but which I knew were there. I am dwelling upon Atwater just for love. I have nothing important to say about Atwater. In fact, only one thing to say about him at all. And even that one thing I could leave unmentioned if I wanted to, but I don't want to. It has been a pleasant memory to me for a whole generation. It lets in a fleeting ray of light upon Livy's gentle and calm and equable spirit. Although she could feel strongly and utter her feelings strongly, none but a person familiar with her and with all her moods would ever be able to tell by her language that that language was violent. Young Charlie had many and many a time tried to lodge a seed of unkindness against Atwater in Livy's heart, but she was as steadfast in her fidelity as was her father, and Charlie's efforts always failed. Many and many a time he brought to her a charge against Atwater which he believed would bring the longed-for bitter word, and at last he scored a success, for all things come to him who waits. I was away at the time, but Charlie could not wait for me to get back. He was too glad, too eager. He sat down at once and wrote to me while his triumph was fresh and his happiness hot and contenting. He told me how he had laid the whole exasperating matter before Livy, and then had asked her, "Now what do you say?" And she said, "Damn Atwater." Charlie knew that there was no need to explain this to me. He knew I would perfectly understand. He knew that I would know that he was not quoting, but was translating. He knew that I would know that his translation was exact, was perfect, that it conveyed the precise length, breadth, weight, meaning, and force of the words which Livy had really used. He knew that I would know that the phrase which she really uttered was, "I disapprove of Atwater." He was quite right. In her mouth, that word disapprove was as blighting and withering and devastating as another person's damn. One or 2 days ago, I was talking about our sorrowful and pathetic brief sojourn in Buffalo, where we became hermits and could have no human comradeship except that of young David Gray and his young wife and their baby boy. It seems an age ago. Last night I was at a large dinner party at Norman Hapgood's palace uptown, and a very long and very slender gentleman was introduced to me, a gentleman with a fine, alert, and intellectual face, with a becoming gold pince-nez on his nose, and clothed in an evening costume which was perfect from the broad spread of immaculate bosom to the rosetted slippers on his feet. His gait, his bows, and his intonations were those of an English gentleman, and I took him for an earl. I said I had not understood his name, and asked him what it was. He said David Gray. The effect was startling. His very father stood before me, as I had known him in Buffalo 36 years ago. This apparition called up pleasant times in the beer mills of Buffalo with David Gray and John Hay, when this David Gray was in his cradle, a beloved and troublesome possession. And this contact kept me in Buffalo during the next hour and made it difficult for me to keep up my end of the conversation at my extremity of the dinner table. The text of my reveries was, what was he born for? What was his father born for? What was I born for? What is anybody born for? His father was a poet, but was doomed to grind out his living in a most uncongenial occupation, the editing of a daily political newspaper. He was a singing bird in a menagerie of monkeys, macaws, and hyenas. His life was wasted. He had come from Scotland when he was 5 years old. He had come saturated to the bones with Presbyterianism of the bluest, the most uncompromising and most unlovely shade. At 33, when I was comrading with him, his Presbyterianism was all gone, and he had become a frank rationalist and pronounced unbeliever. After a few years, news came to me in Hartford that he had had a sunstroke. By and by, the news came that his brain was affected as a result. After another considerable interval, I heard, through Ned House, who had been visiting him, that he was no longer able to competently write either politics or poetry, and was living quite privately and teaching a daily Bible class of young people, and was interested in nothing else. His unbelief had passed away. His early Presbyterianism had taken its place. This was true. Some time after this, I telegraphed and asked him to meet me at the railway station. He came, and I had a few minutes' talk with him, this for the last time. The same sweet spirit of the earlier days looked out of his deep eyes. He was the same David I had known before. great and fine and blemishless in character, a creature to adore. Not long afterward, he was crushed and burned up in a railway disaster at night, and I probably thought then, as I was thinking now, through the gay laughter and chatter fog of that dinner table, what was he born for? What was the use of it? These tiresome and monotonous repetitions of the human life, where is their value? Susie asked that question when she was a little child. There was nobody then who could answer it. There is nobody yet. When Mr. Langdon died on the 6th of August, 1870, I found myself suddenly introduced into what was, to me, a quite new role, that of businessman, temporarily. Friday, February 23rd, 1906. Mr. Clemens tells how he became a businessman, mentions his brother Orion's autobiography. During the previous year or a year and a half, Mr. Langdon had suffered some severe losses through a Mr. Talmage Brown, who was an annex of the family by marriage. Brown had paved Memphis, Tennessee with the wooden pavement so popular in that day. He had done this as Mr. Langdon's agent. Well managed, the contract would have yielded a sufficient profit, but through Brown's mismanagement, it had merely yielded a large loss. With Mr. Langdon alive, this loss was not a matter of consequence and could not cripple the business. But with Mr. Langdon's brain and hand and credit and high character removed, it was another matter. He was a dealer in anthracite coal. He sold this coal over a stretch of country extending as far as Chicago, and he had important branches of his business in a number of cities. His agents were usually considerably in debt to him, and he was correspondingly in debt to the owners of the mines. His death left three young men in charge of the business, young Charlie Langdon, Theodore Crane, and Mr. Slee. He had recently made them partners in the business by gift, but they were unknown. The business world knew J. Langdon, a name that was a power, but these three young men were ciphers without a unit. Slee turned out afterward to be a very able man and the most capable and persuasive negotiator, but at the time that I speak of, his qualities were quite unknown. Mr. Langdon had trained him, and he was well equipped for his headship of the little firm. Theodore Crane was competent in his line, that of head clerk and superintendent of the subordinate clerks. No better man could have been found for that place, but his capacities were limited to that position. He was good and upright and indestructibly honest and honorable, but he had neither desire nor ambition to be anything above chief clerk. He was much too timid for larger work or larger responsibilities. Young Charlie was 21, and not any older than his age. That is to say, he was a boy. His mother had indulged him from the cradle up, and had stood between him and such discomforts as duties, studies, work, responsibility, and so on. He had gone to school only when he wanted to, as a rule, and he didn't want to often enough for his desire to be mistaken for a passion. He was not obliged to study at home when he had the headache, and he usually had the headache, the thing that was to be expected. He was allowed to play when his health and his predilections required it, and they required it with a good deal of frequency, because he was the judge in the matter. He was not required to read books, and he never read them. The results of this kind of bringing up can be imagined. But he was not to blame for them. His mother was his worst enemy, and she became this merely through her love for him, which was an intense and steadily burning passion. It was a most pathetic case. He had an unusually bright mind, a fertile mind, a mind that should have been fruitful, but because of his mother's calamitous indulgence, it got no cultivation and was a desert. Outside of business, it is a desert yet. Charlie's deadly training had made him conceited, arrogant, and overbearing. Slee and Theodore had a heavier burden to carry than had been the case with Mr. Langdon. Mr. Langdon had had nothing to do but manage the business, whereas Slee and Crane had to manage the business and Charlie besides. Charlie was the most difficult part of the enterprise. He was a good deal given to reorganizing and upsetting Mr. Slee's most promising arrangements and negotiations. Then the work had to be all done over again. However, I started to tell how I became all of a sudden a business person, a matter which was entirely out of my line. A careful statement of Mr. Langdon's affairs showed that the assets were worth $800,000 and that against them was merely the ordinary obligations of the business. Bills aggregating perhaps $300,000, possibly $400,000, would have to be paid, half in about a month, the other half in about 2 months. The collections to meet these obligations would come in further along. With Mr. Langdon alive, these debts could be no embarrassment. He could go to the bank in the town or in New York and borrow the money without any trouble. But these boys couldn't do that. They could get $150,000 cash at once, but that was all. It was Mr. Langdon's life insurance. It was paid promptly, but it could not go far. That is, it could not go far enough. It did not fall short much. In fact, only $50,000, but where to get the $50,000 was a puzzle. They wrote to Mr. Henry W. Sage of Ithaca, an old and warm friend and former business partner of Mr. Langdon, and begged him to come to Elmira and give them advice and help. He replied that he would come. Then, to my consternation, the young firm appointed me to do the negotiating with him. It was like asking me to calculate an eclipse. I had no idea of how to begin or what to say. But they brought the big balance sheet to the house and sat down with me in the library and explained and explained and explained until at last I did get a fairly clear idea of what I must say to Mr. Sage. When Mr. Sage came, he and I went to the library to examine that balance sheet, and the firm waited and trembled in some other part of the house. When I got through explaining the situation to Mr. Sage, I got struck by lightning again. That is to say, he furnished me a fresh astonishment. He was a man with a straight mouth and a wonderfully firm jaw. He was the kind of man who puts his whole mind on a thing and keeps that kind of a mouth shut and locked all the way through, while the other man states the case. On this occasion, I should have been grateful for some slight indication from him during my long explanation, which might indicate that I was making at least some kind of an impression upon him, favorable or unfavorable. But he kept my heart on the strain all the way through, and I never could catch any hint of what was passing through his mind. But at the finish he spoke out with that robust decision which was a part of his character, and said, "Mr. Clemens, you've got as clear a business head on your shoulders as I have come in contact with for years. What are you an author for? You ought to be a businessman." I knew better, but it was not diplomatic to say so, and I didn't. Then he said, "All you boys need is my note for $50,000 at 3 months, handed in at the bank, and with that support you will not need the money. If it shall be necessary to extend the note, tell Mr. Arnott it will be extended. The business is all right. Go ahead with it and have no fears. It is my opinion that this note will come back to me without your having extracted a dollar from it at the end of the 3 months." It happened just as he had said. Old Mr. Arnott, the Scotch banker, a very rich and very careful man and lifelong friend of Mr. Langdon, watched the young firm and advised it out of his rich store of commercial wisdom, and at the end of the 3 months the firm was an established and growing concern, and the note was sent back to Mr. Sage without our having needed to extract anything from it. It was a small piece of paper, insignificant in its dimensions, insignificant in the sum which it represented, but formidable was its influence, and formidable was its power because of the man who stood behind it. The Sages and the Twitchells were very intimate. 1 or 2 years later, Mr. Sage came to Hartford on a visit to Joe, and as soon as he had gone away, Twitchell rushed over to our house eager to tell me something, something which had astonished him and which he believed would astonish me. He said, "Why, Mark, you know Mr. Sage, one of the best businessmen in America, says that you have quite extraordinary business talents." Again, I didn't deny it. I would not have had that superstition dissipated for anything. It supplied a long-felt want. We are always more anxious to be distinguished for a talent which we do not possess than to be praised for the 15 which we do possess. All this was in 1870. 35 years drifted by, and a year ago, in this house, Charlie sat by this bed and casually remarked that if he were going to select what he considered the proudest moment of his life, he should say that it was after he had explained the balance sheet to Mr. Sage and had heard him say, "Boy as you are, you carry on your shoulders one of the most remarkable business heads I have ever encountered." Again, I didn't say anything. What could be the use? That appropriation of my great achievement had without doubt been embedded in Charlie's mind for a good many years, and I never could have gotten it out by argument and persuasion. Nothing but dynamite could do it. I wonder if we are not all constructed like that. I think it likely that we all get to admiring other people's achievements and then go on telling about them and telling about them, until insensibly and without our suspecting it, we shove the achiever out and take his place. I know of one instance of this. In the other room you will find a bulky manuscript, an autobiography of my brother Orion, who was 10 years my senior in age. He wrote that autobiography at my suggestion 20 years ago and brought it to me in Hartford from Keokuk, Iowa. I had urged him to put upon paper all the well-remembered incidents of his life and to not confine himself to those which he was proud of, but to put in also those which he was ashamed of. I said I did not suppose he could do it, because if anybody could do that thing, it would have been done long ago. The fact that it has never been done is very good proof that it can't be done. Benvenuto tells a number of things that any other human being would be ashamed of, but the fact that he tells them seems to be very good evidence that he was not ashamed of them. And the same, I think, must be the case with Rousseau and his Confessions. I urged Orion to try to tell the truth and tell the whole of it. I said he couldn't tell the truth, of course. That is, he could not lie successfully about a shameful experience of his, because the truth would sneak out between the lies, and he couldn't help it. That an autobiography is always two things. It is an absolute lie, and it is an absolute truth. The author of it furnishes the lie, the reader of it furnishes the truth. That is, he gets at the truth by insight. In that autobiography, my brother adopts and makes his own an incident which occurred in my life when I was 2½ years old. I suppose he had often heard me tell it. I suppose that by and by he got to telling it himself and told it a few times too often. Told it so often that at last it became his own adventure and not mine. I think perhaps I have already mentioned this incident, but I will state it again briefly. When our family moved by wagon from the hamlet of Florida, Missouri, 30 miles to Hannibal on the Mississippi, they did not count the children, and I was left behind. I was 2½ years old. I was playing in the kitchen. I was all alone. I was playing with a little pyramid of meal which had sifted to the floor from the meal barrel through a hole contributed by a rat. By and by I noticed how still it was, how solemn it was, and my soul was filled with nameless terrors. I ran through the house, found it empty, still, silent, awfully silent, frightfully still and lifeless. Every living creature gone, I the one and sole living inhabitant of the globe, and the sun going down. Then an uncle of mine arrived on horseback to fetch me. The family had traveled peacefully along, I don't know how many hours, before at last someone had discovered the calamity that had befallen it. My brother tells that incident in his autobiography gravely, tells it as an experience of his own, whereas if he had stopped to think a minute, it could properly be a striking and picturesque adventure in the life of a toddling child of 2½. But when he makes it an experience of his own, it does not make a hero of the person it happened to, because there could be nothing heroic or blood-curdling about the leaving behind of a young man 12½ years old. My brother did not notice that discrepancy. It seems incredible that he could write it down as his adventure and not cipher a little on the circumstances, but evidently he didn't, and there it stands in his autobiography as the impressive adventure of a child of 12½. Monday, February 26, 1906. Susie comes to New York with her mother and father. Aunt Clara visits them at the Everett House. Aunt Clara's ill luck with horses. The omnibus incident in Germany. Aunt Clara now ill at Hoffman House, result of horseback accident 30 years ago. Mr. Clemens takes Susie to see General Grant. Mr. Clemens's account of his talk with General Grant. Mr. Clemens gives his first reading in New York. Also tells about one in Boston, memorial to Mr. Longfellow, and one in Washington. From Susie's biography. Papa made arrangements to read at Vassar College the 1st of May, and I went with him. We went by way of New York City. Mama went with us to New York and stayed 2 days to do some shopping. We started Tuesday at 2:30 in the afternoon and reached New York about 6:15. Papa went right up to General Grant's from the station, and Mama and I went to the Everett House. Aunt Clara came to supper with us up in our room. This is the same Aunt Clara who has already been mentioned several times. She had been my wife's playmate and schoolmate from the earliest times, and she was about my wife's age, or 2 or 3 years younger, mentally, morally, spiritually, and in all ways a superior and lovable personality. Persons who think there is no such thing as luck, good or bad, are entitled to their opinion, although I think they ought to be shot for it. However, this is merely an opinion itself. There is nothing binding about it. Clara Spaulding had the average human being's luck in all things save one. She was subject to ill luck with horses. It pursued her like a disease. Every now and then a horse threw her. Every now and then carriage horses ran away with her. At intervals, omnibus horses ran away with her. Usually there was but one person hurt, and she was selected for that function. In Germany once, our little family started from the inn, in Worms I think it was, to go to the station. The vehicle of transportation was a great long omnibus, drawn by a battery of four great horses. Every seat in the bus was occupied, and the aggregate of us amounted to a good 24 persons, possibly one or two more. I said playfully to Clara Spaulding, "I think you ought to walk to the station. It isn't right for you to imperil the lives of such a crowd of inoffensive people as this." When we had gone a quarter of a mile and were briskly approaching a stone bridge which had no protecting railings, the battery broke and began to run. Outside we saw the long reins dragging along the ground, and a young peasant racing after them and occasionally making a grab for them. Presently he achieved success, and none too soon, for the bus had already entered upon the bridge when he stopped the team. The 24 lives were saved. Nobody offered to take up a collection, but I suggested to our friend and excursion comrade, American consul at a German city, that we get out and tip that young peasant. The consul said, with an enthusiasm native to his character, "Stay right where you are. Leave me to attend to that. His fine deed shall not go unrewarded." He jumped out and arranged the matter, and we continued our journey. Afterward, I asked him what he gave the peasant so that I could pay my half. He told me, and I paid it. It is 28 years ago, yet from that day to this, although I have passed through some stringent seasons, I have never seriously felt or regretted that outlay. It was 23 cents. Clara Spaulding, now Mrs. John B. Stanchfield, has a son who is a senior in college and a daughter who is in college in Germany. She is in New York at present, and I went to the Hoffman House yesterday to see her, but it was as I was expecting. She is too ill to see any but physicians and nurses. This illness has its source in a horseback accident which fell to her share 30 years ago, and which resulted in broken bones of the foot and ankle. The broken bones were badly set, and she always walked with a limp afterwards. Some months ago, the foot and ankle began to pain her unendurably, and it was decided that she must come to New York and have the bones rebroken and reset. I saw her in the private hospital about 3 weeks after that operation, and the verdict was that the operation was successful. This turned out to be a mistake. She came to New York a month or 6 weeks ago, and another rebreaking and resetting was accomplished. A week ago, when I called, she was able to hobble about the room by help of crutches, and she was very happy in the conviction that now she was going to have no more trouble. But it appears that this dreadful surgery work must be done over once more, but she is not fitted for it. The pain is reducing her strength, and I was told that it has been for the past 3 days necessary to exclude her from contact with all but physicians and nurses. From Susie's biography, we and Aunt Clara were going to the theater right after supper, and we expected Papa to take us there and to come home as early as he could. But we got through dinner, and he didn't come, and Mama got more perplexed and worried, but at last we thought we would have to go without him. So we put on our things and started downstairs, but before we'd gotten half down, we met Papa coming up with a great bunch of roses in his hand. He explained that the reason he was so late was that his watch stopped, and he didn't notice, and kept thinking it an hour earlier than it really was. The roses he carried were some Colonel Fred Grant sent to Mama. We went to the theater and enjoyed Adonis, word illegible, acted very much. We reached home about 11:30 and went right to bed. Wednesday morning we got up rather late and had breakfast about 9:30. After breakfast, Mama went out shopping, and Papa and I went to see Papa's agent about some business matters. After Papa had gotten through talking to Cousin Charlie, Webster, Papa's agent, we went to get a friend of Papa's, Major Pond, to go and see a dog show with us. Then we went to see the dogs with Major Pond, and we had a delightful time seeing so many dogs together. When we got through seeing the dogs, Papa thought he would go and see General Grant, and I went with him. This was April 29, 1885. Papa went up into General Grant's room, and he took me with him. I felt greatly honored and delighted when Papa took me into General Grant's room and let me see the General and Colonel Grant, for General Grant is a man I shall be glad all my life that I have seen. Papa and General Grant had a long talk together, and Papa has written an account of his talk and visit with General Grant for me to put into this biography. Susie has inserted in this place that account of mine, as follows. April 29, 1885. I called upon General Grant and took Susie with me. The general was looking and feeling far better than he had looked or felt for some months. He had ventured to work again on his book that morning, the first time he had done any work for perhaps a month. This morning's work was his first attempt at dictating, and it was a thorough success, to his great delight. He had always said that it would be impossible for him to dictate anything, but I had said that he was noted for clearness of statement, and as a narrative was simply a statement of consecutive facts, he was consequently peculiarly qualified and equipped for dictation. This turned out to be true, for he had dictated 2 hours that morning to a shorthand writer, had never hesitated for words, had not repeated himself, and the manuscript, when finished, needed no revision. The 2 hours' work was an account of Appomattox, and this was such an extremely important feature that his book would necessarily have been severely lame without it. Therefore, I had taken a shorthand writer there before to see if I could not get him to write at least a few lines about Appomattox. I was his publisher. I was putting his personal memoirs to press at the time, SLC. But he was at that time not well enough to undertake it. I was aware that of all the 100 versions of Appomattox, not one was really correct. Therefore, I was extremely anxious that he should leave behind him the truth. His throat was not distressing him, and his voice was much better and stronger than usual. He was so delighted to have gotten Appomattox accomplished once more in his life, to have gotten the matter off his mind, that he was as talkative as his old self. He received Susie very pleasantly, and then fell to talking about certain matters which he hoped to be able to dictate next day. And he said in substance that, among other things, he wanted to settle once for all a question that had been bandied about from mouth to mouth and from newspaper to newspaper. That question was, with whom originated the idea of the march to the sea? Was it Grant's or was it Sherman's idea? Whether I or someone else, being anxious to get the important fact settled, asked him with whom the idea originated, I don't remember. But I remember his answer. I shall always remember his answer. General Grant said, "Neither of us originated the idea of Sherman's march to the sea. The enemy did it." He went on to say that the enemy, however, necessarily originated a great many of the plans that the general on the opposite side gets the credit for. At the same time that the enemy is doing that, he is laying open other moves which the opposing general sees and takes advantage of. In this case, Sherman had a plan all thought out, of course. He meant to destroy the 2 remaining railroads in that part of the country, and that would finish up that region. But General Hood did not play the military part that he was expected to play. On the contrary, General Hood made a dive at Chattanooga. This left the march to the sea open to Sherman. And so after sending part of his army to defend and hold what he had acquired in the Chattanooga region, he was perfectly free to proceed with the rest of it through Georgia. He saw the opportunity, and he would not have been fit for his place if he had not seized it. He wrote me, the general is speaking, what his plan was, and I sent him word to go ahead. My staff were opposed to the movement. I think the general said they tried to persuade him to stop Sherman. The chief of his staff, the general said, even went so far as to go to Washington without the general's knowledge and get the ear of the authorities, and he succeeded in arousing their fears to such an extent that they telegraphed General Grant to stop Sherman. Then General Grant said, out of deference to the government, I telegraphed Sherman and stopped him 24 hours. And then, considering that that was deference enough to the government, I telegraphed him to go ahead again. I have not tried to give the general's language, but only the general idea of what he said. The thing that mainly struck me was his terse remark that the enemy originated the idea of the march to the sea. It struck me because it was so suggestive of the general's epigrammatic fashion, saying a great deal in a single crisp sentence. This is my account, and signed Mark Twain. Susie resumes. After Papa and General Grant had had their talk, we went back to the hotel where Mama was, and Papa told Mama all about his interview with General Grant. Mama and I had a nice quiet afternoon together. That pair of devoted comrades were always shutting themselves up together when there was opportunity to have what Susie called a cozy time. From Susie's nursery days to the end of her life, she and her mother were close friends, intimate friends, passionate adorers of each other. Susie's was a beautiful mind, and it made her an interesting comrade. And with the fine mind, she had a heart like her mother's. Susie never had an interest or an occupation which she was not glad to put aside for that something which was in all cases more precious to her, a visit with her mother. Susie died at the right time, the fortunate time of life, the happy age. 24 years. At 24, such a girl has seen the best of life. Life is a happy dream. After that age, the risks begin. Responsibility comes, and with it the cares, the sorrows, and the inevitable tragedy. For her mother's sake, I would have brought her back from the grave if I could, but I would not have done it for my own. From Susie's biography. Then Papa went to read in public. There were a great many authors that read that Thursday afternoon beside Papa. I would have liked to have gone and heard Papa read, but Papa said he was going to read in Vassar just what he was planning to read in New York, so I stayed at home with Mama. I think that that was the first exploitation of a new and devilish invention, the thing called an author's reading. This witch's Sabbath took place in a theater and began at 2 p.m. There were 9 readers on the list, and I believe I was the only one who was qualified by experience to go at the matter in a sane way. I knew by my old acquaintanceship with the multiplication table that 9 × 10 are 90, and that consequently the average of time allowed to each of these readers should be restricted to 10 minutes. There would be an introducer, and he wouldn't understand his business. This disastrous fact could be counted upon as a certainty. The introducer would be ignorant, windy, eloquent, and willing to hear himself talk. With 9 introductions to make, added to his own opening speech, well, I could not go on with these harrowing calculations. I foresaw that there was trouble on hand. I had asked for the 6th place in the list. When the curtain went up and I saw that our half-circle of minstrels were all on hand, I made a change in my plan. I judged that in asking for 6th place, I had done all that was necessary to establish a fictitious reputation for modesty, and that there could be nothing gained by pushing this reputation to the limit. It had done its work, and it was time now to leave well enough alone and do better. So I asked to be moved up to 3rd place, and my prayer was granted. The performance began at 2:15, and I, number 3 in a list of 10, if we include the introducer, was not called to the bat until 3:15. My reading was 10 minutes long. When I had selected it originally, it was 12 minutes long, and it had taken me a good hour to find ways of reducing it by 2 minutes without damaging it. I was through in 10 minutes. Then I retired to my seat to enjoy the agonies of the audience. I did enjoy them for an hour or two. Then all the cruelty in my nature was exhausted, and my native humanity came to the front again. By 5:30, 1/3 of the house was asleep, another 1/3 were dying, and the rest were dead. I got out the back way and went home. During several years after that, the author's readings continued. Every now and then we assembled in Boston, New York, Philadelphia, Baltimore, Washington, and scourged the people. It was found impossible to teach the persons who managed these orgies any sense. Also, it was found impossible to teach the readers any sense. Once I went to Boston to help in one of these revels, which had been instigated in the interest of a memorial to Mr. Longfellow. Howells was always a member of these traveling afflictions, and I was never able to teach him to rehearse his proposed reading by the help of a watch and cut it down to a proper length. He couldn't seem to learn it. He was a bright man in all other ways, but whenever he came to select a reading for one of these carousals, his intellect decayed and fell to ruin. I arrived at his house in Cambridge the night before the Longfellow memorial occasion, and I probably asked him to show me his selection. At any rate, he showed it to me, and I wish I may never attempt the truth again if it wasn't 7,000 words. I made him set his eye on his watch and keep game while I should read a paragraph of it. This experiment proved that it would take me 1 hour and 10 minutes to read the whole of it. And I said, and mind you, this is not allowing anything for such interruptions as applause, for the reason that after the first 12 minutes there wouldn't be any. He had a time of it to find something short enough, and he kept saying that he never would find a short enough selection that would be good enough. That is to say, he never would be able to find one that would stand exposure before an audience. I said, it's no matter, better that than a long one, because the audience could stand a bad short one, but couldn't stand a good long one. We got it arranged at last. We got him down to 15 minutes, perhaps. But he and Dr. Holmes and Aldrich and I had the only short readings that day out of the most formidable accumulation of authors that had ever thus far been placed in position before the enemy. A battery of 16. I think that that was the occasion when we had 16. If it wasn't, then it was in Washington in 1888. Yes, I think that that occasion was the time when we had that irresistible, that unconquerable force. It was in the afternoon in the Globe Theater, and the place was packed, and the air would have been very bad, only there wasn't any. I can see that mass of people yet, opening and closing their mouths like fishes, gasping for breath. It was intolerable. That graceful and competent speaker, Professor Norton, opened the game with a very handsome speech, but it was a good 20 minutes long. And a good 10 minutes of it, I think, were devoted to the introduction of Dr. Oliver Wendell Holmes, who hadn't any more need of an introduction than the Milky Way. Then Dr. Holmes recited, as only Dr. Holmes could recite it, The Last Leaf, and the house rose as one individual and went mad with worshipping delight. And the house stormed along and stormed along and got another poem out of the doctor as an encore. It stormed again and got a third one, though the storm was not so violent this time as had been the previous outbreaks. By this time, Dr. Holmes had himself lost a part of his mind, and he actually went on reciting poem after poem until silence had taken the place of encores, and he had to do the last encore by himself. He was the loveliest human being in Boston, and it was a pathetic thing that he should treat himself so. I had learned long ago to stipulate for third place on the program. The performance began at 2 o'clock. My train for Hartford would leave at 4 o'clock. I would need 15 minutes for transit to the station. I needed 10 minutes for my reading. I did my reading in the 10 minutes. I fled at once from the theater, and I came very near not catching that train. I was told afterward that by the time reader number 8 stepped forward and trained his gun on the house, the audience were drifting out of the place in groups, shoals, blocks, and avalanches, and that about that time the siege was raised and the conflict given up, with 6 or 7 readers still to hear from. At the reading in Washington in the spring of 88, there was a crowd of readers. They all came overloaded, as usual. Thomas Nelson Page read 40 minutes by the watch, and he was no further down than the middle of the list. We were all due at the White House at 9:30. The President and Mrs. Cleveland were present, and at 10:30 they had to go away, the President to attend to some official business which had been arranged to be considered after our White House reception, it being supposed by Mr. Cleveland, who was inexperienced in authors' readings, that our reception at the White House would be over by 11:30, whereas if he had known as much about authors' readings as he knew about other kinds of statesmanship, he would have known that we were not likely to get through before time for early breakfast. I think that it was upon the occasion of this visit to Washington that Livy, always thoughtful of me, prepared me for my visit to the Executive Mansion. No, it wasn't. That was earlier. She was with me this time and could look after me herself. Monday, March 5th, 1906. Mrs. Clemens's warning to Mr. Clemens when he attends the Cleveland reception at White House describes the Paris house in which they lived in 1893, also room in Villa Viviani, also dining room in house at Riverdale, tells how Mr. Clemens was dusted off after the various dinners, and the card system of signals, letter from Mr. Gilder regarding Mr. Cleveland's 69th birthday, Mason. I was always heedless. I was born heedless, and therefore I was constantly and quite unconsciously committing breaches of the minor proprieties which brought upon me humiliations which ought to have humiliated me but didn't, because I didn't know anything had happened. But Livy knew, and so the humiliations fell to her share, poor child, who had not earned them and did not deserve them. She always said I was the most difficult child she had. She was very sensitive about me. It distressed her to see me do heedless things, which could bring me under criticism, and so she was always watchful and alert to protect me from the kind of transgressions which I have been speaking of. When I was leaving Hartford for Washington upon the occasion referred to, she said, I have written a small warning and put it in a pocket of your dress vest. When you are dressing to go to the author's reception at the White House, you will naturally put your fingers in your vest pockets, according to your custom, and you will find that little note there. Read it carefully and do as it tells you. I cannot be with you, and so I delegate my sentry duties to this little note. If I should give you the warning by word of mouth, now it would pass from your head and be forgotten in a few minutes. It was President Cleveland's first term. I had never seen his wife, the young, the beautiful, the good-hearted, the sympathetic, the fascinating. Sure enough, just as I had finished dressing to go to the White House, I found that little note which I had long ago forgotten. It was a grave little note, a serious little note, like its writer, but it made me laugh. Livy's gentle gravities often produced that effect upon me, where the expert humorist's best joke would have failed, for I do not laugh easily. When we reached the White House and I was shaking hands with the President, he started to say something, but I interrupted him and said, "If Your Excellency will excuse me, I will come back in a moment, but now I have a very important matter to attend to, and it must be attended to at once." I turned to Mrs. Cleveland, the young, the beautiful, the fascinating, and gave her my card, on the back of which I had written, "He didn't," and I asked her to sign her name below those words. She said, "He didn't? He didn't what?" "Oh," I said, "never mind, we cannot stop to discuss that now. This is urgent. Won't you please sign your name?" I handed her a fountain pen. "Why," she said, "I cannot commit myself in that way. Who is it that didn't, and what is it that he didn't?" "Oh," I said, "time is flying, flying, flying. Won't you take me out of my distress and sign your name to it? It's all right, I give you my word it's all right." She looked nonplussed, but hesitatingly and mechanically she took the pen and said, "I will sign it, I will take the risk. But you must tell me all about it right afterward so that you can be arrested before you get out of the house in case there should be anything criminal about this." Then she signed, and I handed her Mrs. Clemens's note, which was very brief, very simple, and to the point. It said, "Don't wear your arctics in the White House." It made her shout, and at my request, she summoned a messenger, and we sent that card at once to the mail on its way to Mrs. Clemens in Hartford. During 1893 and 94, we were living in Paris, the first half of the time at the Hotel Brighton, in the Rue de Rivoli, the other half in a charming mansion in the Rue de l'Université, on the other side of the Seine, which, by good luck, we had gotten hold of through another man's ill luck. This was Pomeroy, the artist. Illness in his family had made it necessary for him to go to the Riviera. He was paying $3,600 a year for the house, but allowed us to have it at $2,600. It was a lovely house, large, quaint, indefinite, charmingly furnished and decorated, built upon no particular plan, delightfully rambling, uncertain, and full of surprises. You were always getting lost in it, and finding nooks and corners and rooms which you didn't know were there and whose presence you had not suspected before. It was built by a rich French artist, and he had also furnished it and decorated it with his own hand. The studio was coziness itself. We used it as a drawing room, sitting room, living room, dancing room. We used it for everything. We couldn't get enough of it. It is odd that it should have been so cozy, for it was 40 feet long, 40 feet high, and 30 feet wide, with a vast fireplace on each side in the middle, and a musician's gallery at one end. But we had before this found out that, under the proper conditions, spaciousness and coziness do go together most affectionately and congruously. We had found it out a year or two earlier when we were living in the Villa Viviani, 3 miles outside the walls of Florence. That house had a room in it which was 40 feet square and 40 feet high, and at first we couldn't endure it. We called it the Mammoth Cave. We called it the Skating Rink. We called it the Great Sahara. We called it all sorts of names, intended to convey our disrespect. We had to pass through it to get from one end of the house to the other, but we passed straight through and did not loiter. And yet before long, and without our knowing how it came about, we found ourselves infesting that vast place day and night, and preferring it to any other part of the house. 4 or 5 years ago, when we took a house on the banks of the Hudson, at Riverdale, we drifted from room to room on our tour of inspection, always with a growing doubt as to whether we wanted that house or not. But at last, when we arrived in a dining room that was 60 feet long, 30 feet wide, and had 2 great fireplaces in it, that settled it. But I have wondered. What I was proposing to talk about was quite another matter, to wit. In that pleasant Paris house, Mrs. Clemens gathered little dinner companies together once or twice a week, and it goes without saying that in these circumstances my defects had a large chance for display. Always, always, without fail, as soon as the guests were out of the house, I saw that I had been miscarrying again. Mrs. Clemens explained to me the various things which I had been doing which should have been left undone, and she was always able to say, I have told you over and over again, yet you do these same things every time, just as if I never had warned you. The children always waited up to have the joy of overhearing this. Nothing charmed them, nothing delighted them, nothing satisfied their souls like seeing me under the torture. The moment we started upstairs, we could hear scurrying garments, and we knew that those children had been at it again. They had a name for this performance. They called it dusting off Papa. They were obedient young rascals as a rule, by habit, by training, by long experience. But they drew the line there. They couldn't be persuaded to obey the command to stay out of hearing when I was being dusted off. At last I had an inspiration. It is astonishing that it had not occurred to me earlier. I said, Why, Livy, you know that dusting me off after these dinners is not the wise way. You could dust me off after every dinner for a year, and I should always be just as competent to do the forbidden thing at each succeeding dinner as if you had not said a word, because in the meantime I have forgotten all these instructions. I think the correct way is for you to dust me off immediately before the guests arrive, and then I can keep some of it in my head and things will go better. She recognized that that was wisdom, and that it was a very good idea. Then we set to work to arrange a system of signals to be delivered by her to me during dinner, signals which would indicate definitely which particular crime I was now engaged in, so that I could change to another. Apparently, one of the children's most precious joys had come to an end and passed out of their life. I supposed that that was so, but it wasn't. The young unteachables got a screen arranged, so that they could be behind it during the dinner and listen for the signals and entertain themselves with them. The system of signals was very simple, but it was very effective. If Mrs. Clemens happened to be so busy at any time talking with her elbow neighbor that she overlooked something that I was doing, she was sure to get a low-voiced hint from behind that screen in these words, Blue card, Mama, or red card, Mama, green card, Mama, so that I was under double and triple guard. What the mother didn't notice, the children detected for her. As I say, the signals were quite simple, but very effective. At a hint from behind the screen, Livy would look down the table and say, in a voice full of interest, if not of counterfeited apprehension, What did you do with the blue card that was on the dressing table? That was enough. I knew what was happening, that I was talking the lady on my right to death and never paying any attention to the one on my left. The blue card meant, Let the lady on your right have a reprieve. Destroy the one on your left. So I would at once go to talking vigorously to the lady on my left. It wouldn't be long till there would be another hint, followed by a remark from Mrs. Clemens, which had in it an apparently casual reference to a red card, which meant, Oh, are you going to sit there all the evening and never say anything? Do wake up and talk. So I waked up and drowned the table with talk. We had a number of cards of different colors, each meaning a definite thing, each calling attention to some crime or other in my common list. And that system was exceedingly useful. It was entirely successful. It was like Buck Fanshawe's riot. It broke up the riot before it got a chance to begin. It headed off crime after crime all through the dinner, and I always came out at the end successful, triumphant, with large praises owing to me, and I got them on the spot. It is a far call back over the accumulation of years to that night in the White House when Mrs. Cleveland signed the card. Many things have happened since then. The Cleveland family have been born since then. Ruth, the firstborn whom I never knew but with whom I corresponded when she was a baby, lived to reach a blooming and lovely young maidenhood, then passed away. Today comes this letter, and it brings back the Clevelands and the past and my lost little correspondent. Editorial Department, The Century Magazine, Union Square, New York, March 3, 1906. My dear Mr. Clemens, President Finley and I are collecting letters to ex-President Cleveland from his friends, appropriate to his 69th birthday. If the plan appeals to you, will you kindly send a sealed greeting under cover to me at the above address, and I will send it and the other letters south to him in time for him to get them all together on the 18th of the present month. Yours sincerely, R. W. Gilder, G. Mr. Samuel L. Clemens. When the little Ruth was about a year or a year and a half old, Mason, an old and valued friend of mine, was consul general at Frankfurt on the Main. I had known him well in 1867, 68, and 69 in America, and I and mine had spent a good deal of time with him and his family in Frankfurt in 78. He was a thoroughly competent, diligent, and conscientious official. Indeed, he possessed these qualities in so large a degree that among American consuls he might fairly be said to be monumental. For at that time our consular service was largely, and I think I may say mainly, in the hands of ignorant, vulgar, and incapable men who had been political healers in America, and had been taken care of by transference to consulates where they could be supported at the government's expense instead of being transferred to the poorhouse, which would have been cheaper and more patriotic. Mason, in 78, had been consul general in Frankfurt several years, four, I think. He had come from Marseille with a great record. He had been consul there during 13 years, and one part of his record was heroic. There had been a desolating cholera epidemic, and Mason was the only representative of any foreign country who stayed at his post and saw it through. And during that time, he not only represented his own country, but he represented all the other countries in Christendom and did their work, and did it well and was praised for it by them in words of no uncertain sound. This great record of Mason's had saved him from official decapitation straight along while Republican presidents occupied the chair, but now it was occupied by a Democrat. Mr. Cleveland was not seated in it, he was not yet inaugurated, before he was deluged with applications from Democratic politicians desiring the appointment of 1,000 or so politically useful Democrats to Mason's place. Mason wrote me and asked me if I couldn't do something to save him from destruction. Tuesday, March 6th, 1906. Mr. Clemens makes Baby Ruth intercede in behalf of Mr. Mason, and he is retained in his place. Mr. Clemens's letter to ex-President Cleveland. Mr. Cleveland is sheriff in Buffalo. As mayor, he vetoes ordinance of railway corporation. Mr. Clemens and Mr. Cable visit Governor Cleveland at Capitol, Albany. Mr. Clemens sits on the bells and summons 16 clerks. The Lion of St. Mark. I was very anxious to keep him in his place, but at first I could not think of any way to help him, for I was a mugwump. We, the mugwumps, a little company made up of the unenslaved of both parties, the very best men to be found in the two great parties, that was our idea of it, voted 60,000 strong for Mr. Cleveland in New York and elected him. Our principles were high and very definite. We were not a party. We had no candidates. We had no axes to grind. Our vote laid upon the man we cast it for, no obligation of any kind. By our rule, we could not ask for office. We could not accept office. When voting, it was our duty to vote for the best man, regardless of his party name. We had no other creed. Vote for the best man. That was creed enough. Such being my situation, I was puzzled to know how to try to help Mason, and at the same time save my mugwump purity undefiled. It was a delicate place. But presently, out of the ruck of confusions in my mind, rose a sane thought, clear and bright. To wit, since it was a mugwump's duty to do his best to put the best man in office, necessarily it must be a mugwump's duty to try to keep the best man in when he was already there. My course was easy now. It might not be quite delicate for a mugwump to approach the president directly, but I could approach him indirectly, with all delicacy, since in that case not even courtesy would require him to take notice of an application which no one could prove had ever reached him. Yes, it was easy and simple sailing now. I could lay the matter before Ruth in her cradle and wait for results. I wrote the little child and said to her all that I have just been saying about mugwump principles and the limitations which they put upon me. I explained that it would not be proper for me to apply to her father in Mr. Mason's behalf, but I detailed to her Mr. Mason's high and honorable record, and suggested that she take the matter in her own hands and do a patriotic work which I felt some delicacy about venturing upon myself. I asked her to forget that her father was only President of the United States and her subject and servant. I asked her not to put her application in the form of a command, but to modify it and give it the fictitious and pleasanter form of a mere request, that it would be no harm to let him gratify himself with the superstition that he was independent and could do as he pleased in the matter. I begged her to put stress, and plenty of it, upon the proposition that to keep Mason in his place would be a benefaction to the nation, to enlarge upon that and keep still about all other considerations. In due time, I received a letter from the president, written with his own hand, signed by his own hand, acknowledging Ruth's intervention and thanking me for enabling him to save to the country the services of so good and well-tried a servant as Mason, and thanking me also for the detailed fullness of Mason's record, which could leave no doubt in anyone's mind that Mason was in his right place and ought to be kept there. In the beginning of Mr. Cleveland's second term, a very strong effort to displace Mason was made, and Mason wrote me again. He was not hoping that we would succeed this time, because the assault upon his place was well organized, determined, and exceedingly powerful, but he hoped I would try again and see what I could do. I was not disturbed. It seemed to me that he did not know Mr. Cleveland, or he would not be disturbed himself. I believed I knew Mr. Cleveland, and that he was not the man to budge an inch from his duty in any circumstances, and that he was a Gibraltar against whose solid bulk the whole Atlantic of assaulting politicians would dash itself in vain. I wrote Ruth Cleveland once more. Mason remained in his place, and I think he would have remained in it without Ruth's intercession. There have been other presidents since, but Mason's record has protected him, and the many and powerful efforts to dislodge him have all failed. Also, he has been complimented with promotions. He was promoted from Consul General in Frankfurt to Consul General at Berlin, our highest consular post in Germany. A year ago he was promoted another step, to the Consul Generalship in Paris, and he holds that place yet. Ruth, the child, remained not long in the earth to help make it beautiful and to bless the home of her parents. But little creature as she was, she did high service for her country, as I have shown, and it is right that this should be recorded and remembered. In accordance with the suggestion made in Gilder's letter, as copied in yesterday's talk, I have written the following note to ex-President Cleveland. Honored sir, your patriotic virtues have won for you the homage of half the nation and the enmity of the other half. This places your character as a citizen upon a summit as high as Washington's. The verdict is unanimous and unassailable. The votes of both sides are necessary in cases like these, and the votes of the one side are quite as valuable as are the votes of the other. Where the votes are all in a public man's favor, the verdict is against him. It is sand, and history will wash it away. But the verdict for you is rock, and will stand. S. L. Clemens. As of date, March 18, '06. When Mr. Cleveland was a member of a very strong and prosperous firm of lawyers in Buffalo just before the '70s, he was elected to the mayoralty. Presently, a formidably rich and powerful railway corporation worked an ordinance through the city government, whose purpose was to take possession of a certain section of the city inhabited altogether by the poor, the helpless, and the inconsequential, and drive those people out. Mr. Cleveland vetoed the ordinance. The other members of his law firm were indignant and also terrified. To them, the thing which he had done meant disaster to their business. They waited upon him and begged him to reconsider his action. He declined to do it. They insisted. He still declined. He said that his official position imposed upon him a duty which he could not honorably avoid. Therefore, he should be loyal to it. That the helpless situation of these inconsequential citizens made it his duty to stand by them and be their friend, since they had no other. That he was sorry if this conduct of his must bring disaster upon the firm, but that he had no choice. His duty was plain, and he would stick to the position which he had taken. They intimated that this would lose him his place in the firm. He said he did not wish to be a damage to the co-partnership, therefore they could remove his name from it, and without any hard feeling on his part. During the time that we were living in Buffalo in 70 and 71, Mr. Cleveland was sheriff, but I never happened to make his acquaintance or even see him. In fact, I suppose I was not even aware of his existence. 14 years later, he was become the greatest man in the state. I was not living in the state at the time. He was governor and was about to step into the post of President of the United States. At that time, I was on the public highway in company with another bandit, George W. Cable. We were robbing the public with readings from our works during 4 months, and in the course of time we went to Albany to levy tribute, and I said, we ought to go and pay our respects to the governor. So Cable and I went to that majestic Capitol building and stated our errand. We were shown into the governor's private office, and I saw Mr. Cleveland for the first time. We three stood chatting together. I was born lazy, and I comforted myself by turning the corner of a table into a sort of seat. Presently the governor said, Mr. Clemens, I was a fellow citizen of yours in Buffalo a good many months, a good while ago, and during those months you burst suddenly into a mighty fame, out of a previous long, continued, and no doubt proper obscurity. But I was a nobody, and you wouldn't notice me nor have anything to do with me. But now that I have become somebody, you have changed your style, and you come here to shake hands with me and be sociable. How do you explain this kind of conduct? Oh, I said, it is very simple, Your Excellency. In Buffalo, you were nothing but a sheriff. I was in society. I couldn't afford to associate with sheriffs. But you are a governor now, and you are on your way to the presidency. It is a great difference, and it makes you worthwhile. There appeared to be about 16 doors to that spacious room. From each door, a young man now emerged, and the 16 lined up and moved forward and stood in front of the governor with an aspect of respectful expectancy in their attitude. No one spoke for a moment. Then the governor said, "You are dismissed, gentlemen. Your services are not required. Mr. Clemens is sitting on the bells." There was a cluster of 16 bell buttons on the corner of the table. My proportions at that end of me were just right to enable me to cover the whole of that nest, and that is how I came to hatch out those 16 clerks. While I think of it, last year when we were summering in that incomparable region, that perfection of inland grace and charm and loveliness which is not to be found elsewhere on the planet, the New Hampshire hills, our nearest neighbors were the Abbott Thayers, that family of gifted artists, old friends of mine. They lived downhill in a break in the forest, a quarter or a half mile away. And for a few days they had as guests a couple of bright and lovely young fellows, to wit, Binner, the young poet, a member of McClure's magazine staff, and Guy Faulkner, of the staff of another of the magazines. I had never seen them, but as their trade and mine was the same, they wanted to come and see me. They discussed the proprieties of this invasion a day or two and tried to make up their minds. They knew Miss Lyon, my secretary, very well. At last one of them said, "Oh, come, it'll be all right. Let's go up and see the lions." The other said, "But how do we know that the old lion is there just now?" To this remark came the reply, "Well, we can see the lion, L-Y-O-N, of St. Mark, anyway."